Hi, this is Mike Williams. I'd like to take the next few minutes of your time to share with you actually a very personal journey for me. It's a journey into understanding the gospel. The gospel has been a major influence, impact. We also know that there's many various and sundry versions of the gospel, depending on not just Christianity, but even within Christianity, many different understandings of what the gospel actually means. The one thing we know about the word gospel is that it means good news. And in my own journey of struggle, of trying to come to grips with the contradictions in my life and the things that I myself was disapproving of, not even that it was even God disapproving and society, but also the things that I felt very disapproving of myself. I don't know how many of you have ever felt that before, that not only did you feel that God did not approve of you and that there really was no way to gain his approval or society's approval, and there was no way to get around that or to gain it. But it's another thing altogether to know that you live in such disapproval of your own self. If you've never experienced that, this next few minutes probably is not going to help you all of that much. But if you've ever known what it was like to feel less than, or even to feel more than, this next few minutes may gain some insight that will cause your heart to be at peace and resolve maybe even a lot of issues about things that we believe. You know, as I was growing up, I was raised in a denominational church. Actually, I was sent to a denominational church, and I learned enough to come to believe that God was angry with me. I learned enough to believe that if I tried real hard, that God would somehow approve of me, that if I confessed my sins, that things would be all right, that if I did good, that God would do good things to me and for me, and that if I did bad things, that God in exchange would either do or allow bad things to happen in my life. Those contradictions began to plague my life, even as I went into the ministry, without going into great detail about that, and teaching very emphatically these views and those things without hesitation at all. As I continued in ministry for several years, even pastoring a church for some years, I began to realize that all of the things that I had adhered to of cause and effect belief system within the confines of my Christianity, I began to realize that these were in serious trouble in my own heart and mind. I was in serious trouble because of them. The conflict and the realization that almost felt like the Ecclesiastes preacher, you know, instead of the preacher of the gospel. I felt like, you know, what's the use? David said he had never seen the righteous forsaken, and the Ecclesiastes preacher said just the opposite. He said, you know, I watched the good people beg and grovel, and I watched the wicked go scot-free. And so this is not a new issue that we're dealing with. This is age-old issues as far as life is concerned. And the question today is that I would like to pose to you, as I have posed to myself, does the gospel itself have any resolve for these things? Does the gospel have the power, literally, to put my heart at ease and at peace with truth, and not in pursuit of something, but just because the gospel is? Does it have something that it can offer my life and your life and indeed the entire planet of people? Does it have something to offer everyone's life? as I began to teach and was pastoring by this time in this particular story, I started seeing something in the Bible that I could not arrest myself from studying. I was drawn to it. I couldn't get away from it. And I had never heard anybody teach on it, and yet it's made reference to many times in the New Testament, and actually made reference to many times also in the Scriptures in the Old Testament. And that is the subject of the gospel of peace. Good news of peace. Good news of peace. As I started looking at this and seeing what is the gospel of peace? What does that mean? I had no clue what the gospel of peace even meant. And as I began to do just some basic study about the words, it's like, I need to just find out what these words mean, because it seems to be a very powerful thing according to Paul's teaching, the gospel of peace. And then I realized that not only does the word gospel mean good news, but the term peace does not necessarily mean that with good news you can have peace in your heart, which thank God for every degree of peace that anyone has in their heart. But this actually meant good news, there is a cessation of hostilities. There is an elimination of anger and a hostile situation. The term peace here literally means the absence of war. It literally means the absence of conflict, that conflict has been resolved. Good news, the conflict is over. And so that intrigued me, because I was in great conflict. I was in great conflict with God. I was in a conflict with the devil. I was in conflict with people. My own heart was in conflict with itself. My doctrines were in conflict with each other. I believed in the mercy of God and the love of God, yet I had to be on the other side of this, trying to, quote, balance this whole the whole thing out, and to attest of God's anger and his wrath and his judgment also. And all of these things just were very much in conflict and doing a number on my mind and my heart and my soul, because things just weren't gelling at all. As I studied the gospel of peace, I found out that even though, and let me say this at this juncture, that all of the points that we're going to be talking about in this particular session, that all of these points I speak of in greatest detail, in context, chapter after chapter, book after book of the Old Testament and the New Testament, bringing out the truth of these wonderful things that that I believe are the gospel itself. When I went to the book of Isaiah, and I found out that the prophet Isaiah began to speak and speak about a judgment that was coming that he portrayed as being quite similar to the flood that took place in Noah's time, where that the entire planet, save Noah and his family, the entire planet was destroyed. And then through the prophet Isaiah, God said that as he was speaking about the cross, he said, now this is as the waters of Noah unto me. And begin to explain that there was a promise that came out of the flood, and therefore there would be a promise that would come out of the cross. And the promise, of course, that we all know that came out of the flood is signified by the rainbow that promises the entire earth, that God will never flood this planet again with water. The first thing I had to ask myself is to whom is that promise given, and who benefits from that promise? Well, we all know who benefits from that promise: the Christian, the atheist, the Buddhist, the Hindu, the Muslim, It makes absolutely no difference what race, creed, or color. That rainbow in the sky means exactly the same thing to everyone, whether they understand it or not. We understand from the scriptures that that rainbow is a sign of a promise that never again is it even a consideration that God will ever flood this planet again with water. It just is not going to happen. But the promise then he compares in Isaiah 54 is that a promise would come out of the cross. Now that promise was, I will never be angry with you again, saith the Lord, and the covenant of my peace will never be removed, saith God. He said, now the mountains may fall in the sea. He said, the hills might get removed. But you've got to understand that just like I promised out of the flood of Noah, that with the symbol of the rainbow, that there would never, ever be judgment through water for anybody on this earth. There would never be judgment through water for any human on this earth, believer, unbeliever, love God, hate God, that there would never be a human being ever experience a death through a worldwide flooding of the earth, that would never happen again. No one will ever be hurt that way. So this establishes something that I don't think that we've embraced to this point. At least I had not in my life. That God can make promises that he carries out to people who don't believe anything. This is true. We know that this is true. That God can carry out promises to people who hate him. God can carry out a promise to people who ignore him. God can carry out promises to anyone of race, creed, or color. God can carry out a promise to people of every religion. So we have a precedent, first off. Is it possible for God to fulfill a promise and it have nothing to do with anyone's belief, have nothing to do with anything that anybody says, does, whether they know about it or not? Is it a precedent in the Word of God that God can carry out a promise without man's agreement? We have it. We have it clearly, and this is something so basic and so essentially basic that we all know that this promise was carried out. We all know that the power of this promise is here and alive today, and it affects believer, non-believer, and all religions and all faiths. So we have the precedent. Let me say it again. It's so vitally important. Our first question is, can God carry out a promise to people who don't believe anything? The answer is obviously yes. So, as we proceed, now let's get the promise that comes out of the cross. The promise that came out of the cross was that God would never, ever be angry again. God would never be angry again. And in fact, he called it a covenant of peace that would be established out of the cross. And he said, I will never be angry again. Now, by comparison, you see, we must hold the comparison that God himself, through the prophet Isaiah, established. God himself established the fact, I can make a promise and carry it out whether anybody believes or not. I can do that. The second thing he said was, now this promise through the flood, I want to compare it. Not me, not Isaiah, but God himself said, I want to compare the flood where I carried out a promise that had nothing to do with anyone's beliefs at all or their actions at all. I want to compare that to the cross. God said, I want to compare that to the cross. And this is the promise. I will never be angry again. I will never be angry again. And I will establish a promise that will come out of the cross called the covenant of peace that will never be removed off of the earth. There may be mountains fall flat in the sea. There may be catastrophe and catastrophic events around this world, but it will not be by my hand. Read the rest of Isaiah 54. You will enjoy it. So we have this comparison by God himself. He is establishing here not the way that he established promises under the law, where he said, I will do this if you do that. But you see, this promise was established long before the law. God's conduct of making a promise and carrying it out, regardless of man's beliefs or obedience whatsoever, was established prior to the law. So we have something now but we know that as long as the law is in existence, as long as the law is here, that God's promises are based on, if you do, I will. I'll carry out my promise if you will keep your commitment to me. So here we see another concept, that if the clarity of this is going to hold true, the only time when God can carry out a promise without man's involvement is where there is no law. That's vitally important. It's vitally important to understand what happened at the cross. Because remember, it wasn't me, it wasn't you, it wasn't even Isaiah who chose to give this comparison of the cross and this immaculate promise that came out of the flood, and the equally and even far greater promise that came out of the cross. We know the cross is a historic issue now. We know it is a fulfilled scripture issue now. And we know that it is something powerful. How many of you listening just at this moment believe there's a possibility that Jesus accomplished more at the cross than what you think he may have, what you think, what even you may have heard any minister say that he accomplished? How many of you think the greater possibility is that Jesus accomplished more at the cross rather than less? Do you think we got it just right? Do you think we have it just right as to what Jesus accomplished at the cross? Or do you believe that man could possibly have underestimated the power of the work of Jesus Christ? These were the questions that began to come to me as a pastor. As I began to share the gospel of peace, it began to beg questions. I began to teach a message that God wasn't angry with anyone. And I could prove it. I could prove it through the scriptures. I could prove it through Isaiah. I could prove it because of the whole thing with the Jesus and the cross and the judgment of God. I could prove it, and people would rejoice that God wasn't angry. What a relief to know that God was not angry with anyone anymore. And all of the analogies, and again, we've got entire teachings on the gospel of peace that you may enjoy tremendously. If the gospel of peace is true, does God have the ability to make a promise outside of man's response and keep that promise? Obviously, the answer to that is yes. Now, when I understood the gospel of peace, which was established without man's agreement, being established by comparison to the promise of that came out of the flood, being established and confirmed that the gospel of peace is not to those that believe. The gospel of peace is the promise that God gave is paramount and equivalent to the promise that came out of the flood, which has nothing to do with man's agreement. Now, I'm not trying to diminish your agreement with God or your belief. Let me say to you very clearly, I'm a very strong believer in Jesus Christ. You see, I believe all of this stuff. I believe the book of Genesis. I believe that God sent his son into this earth. I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. I believe that he is God. I believe with all of my heart, I believe that Jesus preached for 3 years in a way that no one else could ever preach on this earth. I believe that Jesus bore the sin of the entire world. I believe he died on the cross. I believe he rose from the dead. I believe that after he rose from the dead, he preached and taught for 40 days before his ascension back into heaven and is now seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So please understand that there is no diminishing of the work of the cross in this man's testimony of my life and my understanding of the gospel. These are things that are real to me. These are things that are passionate inside my heart because I think there's very powerful reasons to believe in these. The things that began to be brought into question were basically three things. If God is not angry with anyone, why isn't he angry? Don't we read and understand that God hates sin? And the Old Testament establishes the fact that all sin must be touched by the wrath of God. What about righteousness? What about the demand for righteousness? That without righteousness, that man is alienated, separated from God, because he is a righteous God and he cannot affiliate or associate himself with unrighteousness. What about righteousness? If God is not angry with anybody, what about the issue of righteousness? How could he not be angry unless everyone is righteous? The question, is everyone righteous, had to come to my mind. The question about sin had to come to my mind. If I accept the fact that God is no longer angry with anyone. So as this question come, and then the next question that began to roll around in my heart and my mind was, what about judgment? If God has declared peace, what is all of this talk about judgment? What is all of this talk about God coming and destroying and hating this, and he's punishing these people, and he don't like that, and he don't like this? When Isaiah said, once his covenant of peace is established at the cross, he says, I will never be angry again, never. And the covenant of my peace will never, ever be removed. Now, I don't mean to insult your intelligence by any means. I'm sure that if you're listening to this, you're a person who wants to try to understand things in a different light, or maybe just listen to somebody else's opinions and views. But the issue of the fact of what this comparison is, we must maintain the comparison down the line to keep the logic of God himself. This is not my logic. This is God's logic. This is not my comparison. This is God himself's comparison. This is not even Isaiah's comparison. This is God's comparison. Of being able to carry out a promise without anyone on earth being involved in the culmination or the verification of that promise. So we see now that if this is going to carry out, and the questions about sin, we're going to have to look at it that the incredible possibility that God dealt with sin without man doing anything. Could it be that God could have made people righteous without them doing anything? Could it be that God carried out judgment without man being involved? If these things are true, I know something called the gospel. And it really would be good news if these things are true. What about sin? What about sin? God has to carry out wrath on every sin. On every sin. Now, I think you have probably had the same experience that I have. I think you've done some things wrong. I think you've done some things right. Your perception may be you've done more things right than wrong, but you see, under the law, it makes no difference. Because if you've broken one law, you've broken every law. So wrath then would be on every human being regardless. But Paul makes a very interesting statement affirming what is said in Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel, and that is, where there is no law, there's no such thing as sin. Where there is no law, Romans 4:15, there is no such thing as a transgression. You cannot, and that's what sin is. As John spoke of later on, that sin is a transgression of the law. You cannot transgress something that is not there. Now, the question is the law there or is it not? The issue with the law of, in fact, Paul calls it the law of sin and death. He speaks of extensively in 2 Corinthians and says that the law has been abolished. It's been done away with. It has been removed. Ephesians says that the law has been nailed to his cross and taken out of the way. So if the law has been taken out of the way, where was it? It was in the way. It wasn't there for you. The law was not there for you. The law was there for God to be able to show us something greater. What would be greater than keeping God's laws and getting God's promise? What could be greater than that? It would be God carrying out his promise without the law. That would be the most magnificent thing that could possibly happen to the human race. Because you see, if God only carries out his promise to those who keep the law, no one will see the promise of God. No one will ever be righteous. Because all you have to do is offend in one point of the law and you're guilty of breaking every law in the book. So the issue of sin, boy, it's a big issue. But is sin something that we deal with every day, all the time? Or is sin now a past tense issue that somehow in the minds of the Catholic Church, which is, you've got to realize that Catholicism established the basic tenets of this trying to close this gap between us and God. That Catholicism and established it. The Reformation did not take away these things. The Reformation caused us to see things in a different light, separate from the authority of the Pope. But these issues were not truly addressed even during the Reformation. Is it time for another Reformation? Is it time for a Reformation that would affect this planet in such a powerful way, based on truth, based on a continuing progress and process of understanding the gospel? You see, many people would say, but how can that be true? We've preached these things for hundreds of years. But you see, the things that were preached before Protestantism came along, they were preached for 1,500 years. 1,500 years before there was a change in the mindset, before there was a break from having to go through the Pope or a priest for remission of sin. 1,500 years. Now we've only been 500. I mean, by comparison, we're talking about things moving forward quite swiftly, actually. But we would be fools to think that the Reformation brought the full understanding. And I'm going to tell you, I would be a fool to tell you that at this point, I have full understanding of the work of the cross. I believe no matter how good I tell you God is, he's better than that. I believe no matter how wonderful I tell you the gospel is, then and how powerful it is, I believe the gospel is more powerful than my words can convey to you. I believe the love of God is so great that my understanding falls way short of that love. I believe that God's mercy, which David said endures forever, is a concept outside of my range of comprehension. These things are matters of the heart. These are very powerful matters of the heart. and to be released out from under the burden of sin, not just because you're a believer, because all of you that have believed know that you know that feeling and that sense of relief from sin. You know that feeling very well. My challenge to you is that you could have that every day of your life without ever addressing sin again. Ever. Could it be that the work of the cross did away with the issue of sin completely? This is a question that the gospel of peace absolutely demands be answered. You see, if there is still sin, God must still be angry. If there is sin, because all sin must be touched by the wrath of God. You say, well, Mike, what, but see, my sin has to be touched by the wrath of God. Even you quoted Isaiah in saying that, or the scriptures in saying that. That is true. But the fact of it is that the Bible tells us that when John saw Jesus, he said, "Behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world." Another promise, not based on law, not based on if you do this, I'll do that. But again, God showing himself capable, able, willing to make a promise without man's adherence to any laws, rules, or regulations, or to even include man in the process of. Again, we see this willingness on God's part. The fact of it is, folks, if there's any promise that comes from God, it will be because God decided to do it himself. There is no one that you know who has ever received a promise from God, old covenant or new, that has ever received a promise from God based on them keeping the law. Because one law qualifies you in the eyes of the law as having broken all law. The issue of sin is big. It is way bigger than the time that I can give it on this one single CD. But again, there's volumes of material for you to follow up on if you should choose to. The second one that we mentioned was the issue of righteousness. Can God carry out something upon a person's life without their agreement? You see, this is still the line of thought that we're following all the way from the promise. Remember the promise that came out of the cross. Can God do something and a promise, or do something and not question or have agreement from man on? Well, we know that pertaining to unrighteousness and pertaining to sin, we understand that according to Romans 5, Paul's a wonderful teaching on this, and this is taught in virtually every church, including Catholicism and all branches of Protestantism that I know of, that because of one man's sin, that God took that sin and charged it against everybody's account. That by one man, sin entered into the world. And Paul teaches eloquently how that God took that sin and he imputed it. He imputed that sin. And that means, even as Paul said, even those who did not sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. We didn't do what Adam did, but we became what Adam was. God didn't ask me. God didn't reveal to me Adam and say, you know, Michael, if you believe this, then you're going to become a sinner too. God said and made it clear and made another precedent, another incredible precedent, that he can do something without man's participation or agreement or man's will being involved. You say, but man's will was involved, but it was the will of one man. That's vitally important, a good thing to bring out. It was the will of one man, and one man affected the entire planet. God chose to take the will of one man and affect, and let me say it this way, infect the entire planet with sin. To impute, That means to charge to your account. That means to be brought against you without any reason for that to be done in your own personal life. Then we have Paul's comparison, which is vitally important, where he compares that in Romans chapter 5, and he says that Jesus is called the last Adam. And by calling Jesus the last Adam, you see, once again, our minds are arrested into a comparative that we do not have a right to come up with our own conclusions from. If Adam is called the first Adam and Jesus is called the last Adam, my mind must remain arrested to this comparison. What does the comparison teach? What does Paul teach about this? What do the scriptures teach about this? This is what it teaches, that by one man's sin, all were made sinners, and that by one man's obedience, all have been made righteous. Again, can God do this? Can God carry out a promise to an entire planet without informing them, without asking them, without including them, without them keeping a law? Well, you see, the only way that Jesus could have made us righteous is if the law had been removed out of the situation. Because this is the way that God operated this. It was not my plan. This was the magnificent plan of God to bring us to the understanding of true righteousness through the law, through the prophets, and to give us an accurate and clear understanding of the work of the cross of Jesus Christ. That by one man's obedience, one man sinned, everybody became sinners, one man obeyed, and everybody became righteous. I want you to ask yourself, is it possible? I know the verses that are running through your head. I do. And believe me, if I was sitting in the living room with you, we would sit down and look at every one of those verses that are bombarding your head right now, and we would look at them, but you know how we would look at them? In context. One of the most tragic things that has ever happened to the mind of the evangelical Christian is that we know verses out of context. Context is very powerful and very revealing indeed. So we have this incredible issue of righteousness that, of course, if Jesus made everybody righteous, again, this would be affirming of the fact that there is no such thing as sin, that sin was done away with, that it was taken, even as the prophet Isaiah said, that God was going to take the issue of sin and that he would remember it no more and that it would be removed from him as far as the east is from the west, that this would not be an issue anymore. So if sin is not an issue, the only reason it could be a non-issue is if everybody is righteous. The only way everybody could be righteous is if God had declared peace. If God declared peace with the entire human race, the only way he could is if everybody is righteous. If there is no, the issue of sin, the only way that there could be sin is if God didn't declare peace. The only way that God could have declared peace is if there is no such thing as sin. As you tell, I get excited about these things. This is my personal testimony of my journey into the truth of the gospel, what I view to be the truth of the gospel. The third thing that we brought into question was the issue of judgment. Now, it is so powerful. Number one, again, we must refer back to the gospel of peace. And that is, if God declared peace and said, if God said, I am going to declare peace through the cross, and it'll be an eternal peace, it'll be a peace that'll never be removed off of the earth, that through the cross, that is what's going to happen. What is it that we need to understand from that? If God said there is no going, that I'm never going to be angry again, listen to that. God said, after the cross, I will never be angry again. And the covenant of my peace will never be removed, saith the Lord. Oh, mountains may fall, hills may depart, but the covenant of my peace will never be removed, saith God. This is the powerful truth about the gospel. We must keep its comparison. We must know that God kept that promise to the world about the flood to everyone. God kept that promise to everyone on the face of planet Earth and never asked what they would believe as to whether or not the promise would be in effect. Judgment, what a big issue. Jesus made an incredible statement in John chapter 12, verse 31. Jesus, as he was getting ready to go to the cross, the teachings of John go all the way up through chapter 12. And then this incredible revelation about the cross begins, and the process of the cross from chapter 12 on through to the end of the book of John is about the crucifixion of Jesus. But Jesus had something to say about his own crucifixion. Now, I think that would be fairly authoritative, don't you? That Jesus had a concept about his crucifixion. I think that would be weighty. I think it'd be weightier than anything anybody else would have to say, is that Jesus' perception of the cross and what was about to happen was evident. Jesus said, now is the judgment of this world. Now is the judgment of this world. Now, the two verses later says, this spake he, pertaining to what manner of death that he would die. So we know that he's talking about the cross. Jesus said that the cross was the judgment of the entire world. What is about to happen? Now, you got to remember in John chapter 3, Jesus said that he did not come to judge the world, but later on he said, it's for judgment that I'm here. So is Jesus confused? Jesus said, I did not come to judge the world, but he said just a few chapters later, but the whole reason I'm here is for judgment. What? I'm not here to judge anybody, but it is for judgment that I am here. Here is the magnificent understanding that Jesus had about the fact he was here to judge no one, but the whole purpose he was here was for judgment. What judgment was he here for? He was here for the judgment of the entire world. Could God carry out a judgment for an entire world without that world's permission? Could God, through that judgment then, leave a promise behind? Even as he did through the waters of Noah, leave a promise behind and say, I'm not angry anymore. Is it possible that God himself could have brought this judgment even as he did in the waters of Noah? Could it be possible that through this judgment that God's anger was satiated once and for all, never to be seen again on the face of planet Earth? Now, folks, you know how convoluted people's views are on this, those who believe that God's judging this and judging that. And even Katrina, the largest disaster, you know how many of the evangelical community said that it was a judgment of God on the gay community there, homosexual community in New Orleans. However, the only section of New Orleans that was not totally devastated by this hurricane was the area where the gays hang out, where all of the, quote, sin takes place. Bourbon Street is still intact. It's people's homes that were leveled. They're still devastated in the Ninth Ward. This whole area was not in this massive destruction of Hurricane Katrina. So we know there's just inconsistencies. I could point them out to you all day long. I could take every story that anybody's ever told you about the judgment of God and show you how ridiculous it is to believe that that could possibly be the judgment of God. Would that be good news? Good news about peace. The only other thing in the Bible called the gospel is called the gospel of God's grace. Would that be gracious? Would this be grace? Would this be something that we did not deserve? Would this be really what the gift of God is? Is something that we don't deserve and don't even have to ask for, but something that we can come to an incredible revelation of and not become a part of the manifestation of it, but simply believe that its manifestation has already come 2,000 years ago. One of the very important things that you'll also have to confront as the understanding of the gospel continues is the issue of the scriptures. You see, Jesus said, "Not one jot or tittle shall pass from the law until all scripture is fulfilled." No part of the law can be done away with unless all the law is done away with. Please hear me, what Jesus established. Any portion of the law that changes means all law has changed. Any portion of the law done away with means all law has done away with. Any portion of scripture fulfilled means all scripture is fulfilled. The law and the prophets go hand in hand. You can't have one single fulfilled prophecy while there's still a law in effect. You cannot have one single law in effect when there has been any prophecy that has been fulfilled. These prophecies were filled on the day of the Lord, the day of judgment, as Isaiah called it. You see, there was a day of judgment, the day of the Lord, that was fulfilled 2,000 years ago in the body of one man, and an immaculate, incredible free gift was bestowed and imputed upon man, charged to our account. You've been charged with righteousness. People will say, but God is a judging God. God still judges. Yes, he does. And I can tell you what that judgment is. God has judged this entire planet as righteous and holy. I'm going to challenge you also in the closing of this short message to you to look and see what Jesus said the scriptures are and where we must rely when we are validating what we believe to be the truth. Now, I've quoted from the New Testament. I've quoted from the Old. But you see, when we begin to try to validate truth, Jesus said that we must rely on the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. That's one thing that evangelical Christianity knows very little about, is the law, the first five books of the Bible, Psalms, or the prophets. They seem to know absolutely nothing about these things. So the power of this is given to us to understand and to walk through. We need to understand there is a place where that all truth can be validated. Now, I'm not telling you not to study the New Testament. I study all of the New Testament. I think the New Testament is wonderful. But you see, when we begin to validate the issues of the cross and the truth of the gospel, it must be validated through the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. I can find great truth and wonderful things in the New Testament, but when I start to validate these things, I've got to know what the scriptures say. And I've got to know what Jesus said the scriptures are. I've got to know that every time that any of the writers of the New Testament spoke about the scriptures, they quoted the law, they quoted the Psalms, and they quoted the prophets. Here's the issue. It's called the gospel. It's called the gospel of peace. It's called the gospel of grace. It is called righteousness. It is the immaculate fulfillment of all things in the body of one man, the man Jesus Christ. I hope that our little time together has helped you to maybe even just provoked you to think about some things. Maybe someone gave this to you for whatever purpose. But if you would like more information about some of the things that you've heard, you can go to gospelrevolution.com. you can go to gospelrevolution.com. Thank you very much for your time.